Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. In the 1980s, researchers noticed that HIV infections were spreading among people who were injecting drugs and sharing needles. Soon, the idea for needle exchanges became popular in the U.S.
From a street corner in Tacoma, he passes out clean needles to IV drug users in exchange for dirty ones. Although it's illegal, the police don't interfere.
The idea started to catch on. By the 1990s, many national health organizations like the American Nurses Association were voicing their support, but there was also a lot of pushback.
As a drug user, you're getting a free pass to exchange your needles. You're not holding people accountable for their actions.
It also meant healthcare workers were giving people tools to inject themselves with drugs, which seemed to violate one of the main tenets of medicine.
Primum non nocere first, do no harm.
But what does doing no harm really mean?
Sometimes in order to do no harm, you have to intervene in a potentially harmful way because you're trying to avoid an even worse outcome.
That's David Katz. He is a physician and founding director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center in Connecticut. He says in medicine, you always have to weigh the benefits and risks.
It's a bad thing to be using intravenous drugs. It implies an addiction. There are all sorts of ways that can damage your health, disrupt your life. On the other hand, needle exchange programs engage people in a therapeutic alliance, create an opportunity to address the addiction at the source, and in the meantime, massively cut down on the risk of infectious diseases, including both HIV and hepatitis.
This kind of approach soon became known as harm reduction. Accepting a potentially dangerous behavior that may not be legal or you may not condone, but making it safer to try to avoid a bigger problem. Think vaping instead of smoking, or schools giving out condoms to teenagers and encouraging safe sex instead of preaching abstinence only.
That's why you should always use a condom.
Now, this is not usually an easy sell.
There's this feeling that harm reduction inherently promotes these activities that are viewed as bad.
Instead, people might say, why don't you just stop the behavior that's getting you in trouble in the first place?
Just say,
no.
You'd be surprised how well it works.
No!
Take it from me. The only way to stop abusing drugs is to stop using them.
But epidemiologist Ellie Murray says the coronavirus pandemic has perhaps made harm reduction a bit more approachable for more people, because now we're all weighing risks and benefits.
Once you start talking about it in terms of COVID, everybody kind of understands, because they didn't want abstinence-only COVID risk, right? That's what lockdown was. It was the abstinence-only version of COVID. And so now it's suddenly everybody can kind of see, oh, actually, harm reduction is not about do all the things that you want to do. It's do the things that are most important to you safely.
On today's episode, what does harm reduction look like in different areas of public health? Addiction, sex work, weight management, and the coronavirus pandemic. First up, addiction. This is where harm reduction got its start. As more and more people were dying from opioid overdoses around the country, many communities made a big effort to get the overdose reversal drug naloxone, also known by its brand name Narcan, into the hands of as many people as possible. The idea is that way anybody can intervene when somebody is overdosing, not just first responders. And anybody means even those who are selling the drugs. Reporter Nina Feldman followed one outreach worker in a Philadelphia neighborhood that's been hit hard by the opioid crisis.
Kensington is just a couple miles north of downtown Philadelphia, but in a lot of ways, it feels like an entirely different ecosystem than the rest of the city. It operates under different rules. People use drugs and sell drugs in plain sight. in parks and on street corners and under bridges. The streets are crowded. There's always a lot of hustle and bustle. Shopkeepers sweep trash and use syringes from in front of their stores where they sell cell phones or discount appliances. Longtime residents come and go. Kids pass by people injecting drugs on their way home from school.
I hate trash day because you don't know if that's a bag or a person. You see over there.
Rosalind Pichardo grew up here. After she lost two siblings to gun violence, she started an organization that supports other families who lost loved ones. But over time, she noticed that gun violence was not the only epidemic plaguing the streets of her neighborhood. One day, she was giving out food to people who were homeless when she saw someone overdose.
And I'm like, well, what? That guy is blue. Can somebody help me out? Is he choking on something? Like, I had no idea. Like, I was kind of naive. I knew people did drugs around here, but I didn't know what an overdose looked like. I just didn't know.
This was happening everywhere. People were dying at alarming rates. So when she found out there was a drug that could reverse overdoses, she started giving out as much as she could.
You guys good with Narcan? Y'all need Narcan or anything?
Roz calls the people she helps her sunshine.
Sunshine!
She says she wanted a word besides addict or any of the other negative terms used for people who use drugs.
You good?
There wasn't really a good alternative, so she sort of made one up.
Sunshine, where your coat at?
Roz loaded up a bag full of snacks and unused syringes and Narcan and hit the streets. On the day I went out with her while she made her rounds, the first person we saw was her cousin.
You got Narcan on you, right?
I need one.
You need one?
He had a couple of nasty-looking wounds on his arm that she wanted to check on.
Oh no,
is it closed up?
Yeah, it's closed up and it's flattened out.
She gave him a packaged cake, some clean socks, and some Narcan to keep on hand.
I wish he wasn't out here. How long has he been out here?
A couple years. I just reversed on that too long ago.
Oh, really?
Roz doesn't just give out Narcan. She also uses it. A lot. She's reversed hundreds of overdoses herself. She keeps track of them in a little black book she keeps in her fanny pack. There was one particular reversal that Roz says changed the way she thought about who she should hand out Narcan to. Roz saw a guy overdosing in front of a line of people waiting for free samples from a drug dealer.
So I run to the guy and he was completely blue and unresponsive and the dealer was still handing out samples while the guy is like, oh damn. And I remember calling, grabbing my phone and saying I need to call 911. And him pulling out a 9mm and saying to me, what are you doing? And I said, I have to call the paramedics because this guy is dying and I only have one Narcan. So he put the gun to my face and said, no, you're not going to call because I'm not done handing out these samples. And I said, well, can you at least help me roll him? And he kicked him on his side and rolled the guy, like using his foot.
Roz was paralyzed with fear. She didn't know whether to leave and get more Narcan and come back or what.
And thankfully, the guy came to and he was okay. So then I went back and a couple days later and gave the dealer Narcan.
To be clear, she's talking about the guy who just held a gun to her head.
Now we're semi-friends where he asked me for Narcan. So I drop it off on his porch. It's like the strangest relationship you could ever have with a person. But yeah.
He has her number and texts her when he runs out. And she drops a bunch of doses off at his house.
So I'm like his Narcan dealer, I guess.
You, Bob, you're not coming. Keep it moving.
After that, when she took to the streets, Roz didn't just hand out Narcan to people using drugs. She thought she might as well offer it to people dealing, too.
If they're going to be selling their stuff, they could at least carry Narcan. I mean, if they're business savvy, they definitely want their customers coming back, right?
If this idea seems kind of fringe, well, so did the notion that drug users would ever carry Narcan themselves. Naloxone was approved by the FDA to reverse opioid overdoses in 1971, but it was really only used by doctors and paramedics for the next 20 years. Starting in the late 80s, during the height of the HIV epidemic, syringe exchanges started preventing many people who use drugs from contracting HIV. That meant the bigger threat was overdosing.
People are living longer, but they happen to be dying of overdose rather than dying of HIV.
Nancy Campbell is a researcher at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute who wrote a book about the history of naloxone. She says it wasn't until syringe exchanges proved successful that people started thinking about shifting naloxone out of the medical realm and into the hands of people using drugs. Back then, that was still a very controversial idea.
Harm reduction was a dirty word in the federal government.
The thinking was that if you knew you could reverse an overdose, that would encourage people to use drugs. Harm reduction advocates think about it the opposite way. The way they see it, people suffering from addiction are going to use drugs regardless. So if there's a tool to stop someone from dying, that tool should be easy for anyone to get and to use. After a decades-long battle, naloxone is now pretty mainstream. 46 states, including Pennsylvania, have waived the need for a prescription, so anyone can purchase doses at a pharmacy. Public health departments distribute naloxone and train people how to use it. Ross has no trouble giving out naloxone to people who use drugs, but the dealers can be a bit more skeptical. So she has a whole strategy for how to approach them. Like any good plan, it revolves around snacks.
I normally carry like Oreos and stuff with people. It's hard to say no.
She starts out by offering food to her sunshines. She says that signals to people that she's an outreach worker and she's there to help. Then she'll offer snacks to the dealers.
Some of them will take it and then I say, well, I have Narcan. Do you carry Narcan? And then that's when some will say yes, some will say no. So the ones who said no, I guarantee that maybe by next week they'll carry it. I'm going to go back and, you know, give some more Oreos and give them my spiel on why they need to carry Narcan.
Yeah, I'll take a couple of the things. I'll give it out.
They gave me one when I left the county because that was confusing.
For Roz, whether she's talking to someone using drugs or selling drugs, her goal is the same.
It's always been in my mind to kind of meet people exactly where they are. I'm not trying to change anybody. I'm just trying to make people smile for a moment. And I think I do that a lot.
Still, the work is emotionally draining. She relies on her faith to get her through. The little book Roz carries with her to track the overdoses she's reversed is actually a pocket-sized Bible. Across the thin pages and fine print, she's jotted the rough demographic information for each person she's saved in Sharpie.
So this was another one, 7/12/2019, male in his 60s, 12/30, two Narcans.
Roz wants to pray for the people whose lives she's saving, but that doesn't always feel appropriate.
Hovering over somebody trying to pray for somebody, thinking about like, lady, you crazy. So I'm like, I just get the little book and just write it in. It's pocket size. And you don't even have to know you're praying for them. Just write in the book. And that'll be my way of praying. Even though I don't like get on my hands and knees or nothing. I'm like, okay, I wrote you in the book. Jesus got you. And that's it. I don't need to say a prayer because they're already in the book.
As usual, she's just trying to meet people where they are.
That's Nina Feldman reporting. She went out with Ross Pichardo to report this story before the coronavirus pandemic hit the U.S. Since then, it appears that overdose deaths have gone up across the country. And that brings us to another hotly contested harm reduction idea, supervised injection sites. These are places where drug users can inject under the watchful eyes of healthcare providers to make sure they have clean spaces, clean needles, and they don't overdose. Several U.S. cities have been debating opening sites like these, but it has led to massive community pushback.
You blindsided us, generations of families who raise our children there.
There's a general uneasiness about the idea, like how can healthcare workers watch people inject drugs right before their eyes? And how will this affect the neighborhood where the site is located? Vancouver, Canada has had supervised injection sites for quite some time. The oldest one is called InSight, and there are several others. Reporter Travis Lupik lives in Vancouver and covers the opioid epidemic. He says these places have not had a negative impact on the surrounding areas.
Are needles that were previously discarded on the streets now be discarded inside and other injection sites. I've seen open drug use that used to take place in shopkeepers' doorways now take place inside Insight and other injection sites. It's been really neat to see business owners in the neighborhood who once marched in the street against supervised injection come around after just a couple years of these sites being open, seeing how they actually, these sites actually help clean up the neighborhood.
But it doesn't sound like this could happen overnight. It sounds like convincing people, talking to people in neighborhoods takes time.
That's a really important point. It took a lot of time in Vancouver. You know, we're sort of put on a pedestal as this pioneer of harm reduction now, but it was not easy. And politicians and a large segment of the public initially went kicking and screaming before they got behind supervised injection and harm reduction. It was, more than anything else, a campaign of education that slowly brought people on board. Vancouver brought experts over from Europe, where these sites like this have operated for many more years. They held dozens and then more than 100 public forums over the 5 years before Insight opened. And today, supervised injection is not a controversial thing in Vancouver. You know, it's just not. I mean, an injection site can open without community kickback now.
Travis Lupik is a reporter in Vancouver, and he's written a book about this topic. It's called Fighting for Space. Over the past couple of decades, harm reduction advocates in the U.S. have pushed to decriminalize sex work, also referred to as prostitution. Those in support say this line of work is always going to exist, and being able to do this without fearing legal repercussions makes things safer. It allows people to be choosier about their clients, to protect themselves against violence. But some people say the U.S. took a step in the other direction with legislation that was passed in 2018. It was intended to stop sex trafficking, but may have had some unintended consequences. Liz Tung has more.
Hey. Hi. Oh, I'm so glad I got the right apartment.
How's it going? Yeah.
I meet Danielle Blunt, who just goes by Blunt, and her friend Ariel Wolf at an eerie Brooklyn apartment near Prospect Park. Blunt offers me a quick tour.
So we're in my office, which is a combination of a traditional office and my kink play space, or my dungeon, if you will.
This is where Blunt, who's a sex worker and professional dominatrix, meets with a lot of her clients. Dungeon is what people in the BDSM community, who are into things like spanking, bondage, and submission, call their dedicated play spaces. I know it's just a term, but I still can't get over how distinctly non-dungeon-y this apartment is.
It's a very, like, beautiful, airy space. Thank you. Yeah, I like to work in natural light. It feels important to me that people look at the thing that they're doing. It's interesting because, like, when I think dungeon, I think most of us, we think, like, dark, like, yeah, underground place. But this, I mean, this could be, like, IKEA showroom.
But in between the macrame plant hangers and tasteful Nordic furniture are some unmistakable tools of the trade.
This is called a hashira. It's a Japanese bondage post, which I will string people up to. And
Blunt also shows me her whip without any warning. Brace your ears.
Why'd you run away? Yeah.
Wait, can you do that again without me screaming?
Oh, you don't think your screaming was an important part of the...
Blunt refers to what she does as sex work. It's a term that was coined in the 1970s to try and get away from the stigma associated with prostitution. Prostitution meant criminality, exploitation, immorality. It was an evil that needed to be abolished. Sex work, on the other hand, was conceived as a form of labor that deserves its own rights and protections. Some people even find it empowering. Here's Blunt's friend, Ariel Wolf. She works as an exotic dancer.
I worked waiting tables for a lot of my early 20s, and honestly, I felt more exploited and degraded in that situation than I ever did dancing.
She also makes more money for far less work. These days, Ariel says she can even afford out-of-network mental health care, something that would have been impossible in her waitressing days.
Just having that financial agency was empowering. So for me, it was a form of autonomy that was, you know, really important. And yeah, I preferred it to waiting tables.
Of course, not all sex work is empowering. It can be exploitative and risky, even downright dangerous. But around the 1990s, sex work started getting a tiny bit safer, thanks to a little something called Craigslist Personals. Craigslist, of course, is the free listings website where people can advertise anything from sublets to secondhand furniture. And in 2002, they added a dedicated erotic services section where sex workers could connect with clients. That was quickly followed by another online behemoth, Backpage.com, along with several straight-up directories of sex workers, like City Vibe and Night Shift. Advocates say this shift online has been good for sex worker safety. In fact, in a study last year, researchers from Baylor University found that Craigslist's erotic services section led to a drop in the female homicide rate of up to 17.6%. That's not including crimes in which victims knew their killers. The authors of the study say this was a direct result of the shift online. It gave sex workers a chance to screen out violent clients and drum up their own business, as opposed to relying on pimps, who are often exploitative. On a bigger level, it also helped empower sex workers to connect with one another, articulate their shared interests and problems, and perhaps most importantly, share lists of dangerous clients. But sex workers weren't the only ones capitalizing on websites like Backpage. Also taking advantage, sex traffickers, who for years openly posted ads for women and children being held against their will. One of those children was Melanie Thompson.
I was 12 years old when I was kidnapped on my way home from a movie theater in the sixth grade. And the person who kidnapped me locked me in a house, in an abandoned house in a closet, and started selling me on the street initially in prostitution. And gradually we had, I guess, advanced, for lack of a better word, from the street to underground strip clubs to Backpage.com, essentially.
Melanie doesn't like the term sex work. In fact, she corrects me when I say it.
So I don't use the term sex work because I like to say that sex work is neither. Sex is not work and work is not sex. And although I recognize that there is a population of people who identify, self-identify as sex workers, it's really a term that's used to mask the inherent harms that comes with prostitution.
Because to her, this isn't some empowering choice. It's a life of exploitation, suffering, and trauma. At an age most girls are hanging out with their friends or going to school dances, Melanie remembers sitting next to her exploiter as he typed up ads to post about her on Backpage.
The ads, it would start with whatever name I was given for the day. It would describe my measurements, so my bust size, my hip size. It would describe my race, and sometimes, because I'm mixed race, so we decided to either stick with one of my races, two of my races, both of them.
Melanie doesn't buy the argument that websites like Backpage make sex work safer. In fact, she says some of her most dangerous jobs came from Backpage.
When I was street walking, it was dangerous, don't get it twisted, but at least I could see the face of somebody from the car. On Backpage, you have to either wait in a hotel room, wait in your apartment, wherever you're engaging in prostitution from, and then wait till the person pops up and see what they look like and see what they're about. Or if you're doing an out call, go to this person's house and hope for the best. And what I found is that because Backpage made it so easy for sex buyers to continue this behavior repeatedly, many of the sex buyers I've encountered on this website were repeat offenders. And many of them have told me out of their own mouths that this was a hobby for them, that they love to quote unquote go shopping.
In fact, Backpage has been so instrumental in sex trafficking that it's faced multiple lawsuits from young women like Melanie. Lawsuits with powerful backers, including former California Attorney General Kamala Harris. But until recently, those lawsuits failed. That's because Backpage and other websites were protected by one of the most important pieces of internet legislation in existence, Section 230. It's part of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. It helps shield web publishers from being legally liable for what users post on their websites. Is basically the free speech protection that's allowed sites like Twitter and Reddit and YouTube to flourish. But a couple years ago, that protection was upended with a passage of a pair of laws called SESTA-FOSTA.
Today we bring, Mr. Speaker, H.R. 1865.
Or some people call it FOSTA-SESTA. SESTA stands for Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, and FOSTA is short for Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act.
The sad truth is that sex trafficking is a crime as old as the nation itself. Over the past few years, Congress has routinely taken bipartisan action to fight it. Yet sex trafficking seems to continue unabated. This is largely because the methods of recruitment and sale of sex trafficking victims have evolved with technology.
Zesta Foster took away the safe harbor protection from any online speech that enables prostitution, including voluntary sex work. The laws passed with strong bipartisan support in 2018, and the effect was immediate.
Has led to the shutdown of the Craigslist personal section.
The adult section with those links for escorts, body rubs, strippers, strip clubs, each of them now has what you see on your screen now, that red censored word on the
back page shut down, as did Craigslist personals and a bunch of other sites, sending droves of sex workers back to the streets. In the years since, advocacy groups have reported a spike in the number of missing and dead sex workers across the country. The thing was, nobody knew for sure what was happening, because no one was studying it. Except, as it turns out, for a pair of 20-something sex workers in New York who decided to take on the project themselves. Re-enter Blunt and Ariel.
I think the main thing we really wanted to find out was just exactly how this was affecting people's financial security, how it was affecting their mental health, and just what experiences individuals were having.
Ariel and Blunt decided to design a study by sex workers for sex workers. So they created a survey that contained 80 questions, some multiple choice, some open-ended, to give respondents a chance to explain their answers.
Barriers to other forms of labor was one of the sections that we were asking people about. So if they had any difficulty finding other jobs, we asked about mental health diagnoses.
Yeah, we really wanted to create a portrait of exactly who was doing this work and why it was so important that they have access to these spaces and how it was affecting them.
They distributed the surveys online and got 110 of them back. After analyzing them, they concluded several impacts, mostly expected. Yes, Sesta Fosta was decreasing financial stability by limiting the ability to advertise. Yes, it was pushing sex workers from online into the streets, and sometimes into the arms of pimps. And yes, all of the above was increasing sex workers' exposure to violence. But Blunt says they also had some unexpected findings.
Well, we found that 50% of our sample group had barriers to other forms of labor, and that the most common barriers were mental health diagnosis, they were chronic illness and disability.
For years, studies have connected sex work with poor health. But researchers have always assumed that the health problems, especially issues with mental health or trauma, stem from the sex work itself. What Blunt and Ariel's survey was telling them was that maybe it was the other way around.
What we found by asking more open-ended questions was that a lot of people were doing sex work because they had this diagnosis previously and their mental health problems were making it difficult for them to hold a 9-to-5 job and that they needed flexibility to work around these issues.
So why would people with disabilities or mental health issues be drawn to sex work? To find out, I talked with Lola. That's not her real name, by the way. She works in healthcare and says she's not out to her job about doing sex work on the side. Anyway, Lola has an autoimmune disease that attacks her muscles. It started when she was in college, but went undiagnosed for years.
The main symptoms are like muscle weakness and muscle pain. And so things that involve standing for a long time, things that involve, lifting things that typically for like a normal quote-unquote person probably wouldn't be such a big deal, but for me can get very fatiguing and very debilitating very quickly.
Throughout college, Lola worked service industry jobs to support herself and pay tuition. But for the most part, those jobs require a lot of standing and movement, which would inevitably be Lola's undoing.
So I remember once I was working in the service industry as a waitress, and I remember just standing behind the counter and holding plates and trying to, carry a bunch of things. And just every part of my body felt like it was just screaming at me.
In her mid-20s, Lola started volunteering with an activist group that focused on sex work issues. As she got to know more and more sex workers, Lola started thinking, hey, I could do this. So she posted a profile on a website, and her sex work career was off and running. Lola says she finds sex work empowering. She enjoys it and gives her confidence. It also gave her the chance to work a job that was both flexible enough and well-paid enough to accommodate her illness.
as a person who has a lot of medical bills, like I don't have to worry about going to the doctor and not being able to pay my copay. I can do that whenever I want to, and being able to do other alternative therapies that make my body feel better, like massage or acupuncture, all of that stuff has been so much easier because I have an income that can support it.
Because of that, Lola's been able to do something she never would have thought she could. She's currently working on 2 advanced degrees and is able to do that without having to worry about money.
I don't have to worry about choosing between, you know, paying for my medical bills and paying for my tuition.
All of that stress and more came flooding back with the passage of SESTA FOSTA. It got harder to find new clients, which meant work started drying up. And then there was a more immediate concern, getting charged with a crime.
It was also just really, really scary and stressful because we didn't know what was going to happen. We were hearing about raids that were happening in various places. And you know, for those of us that were out, I think, you know, you felt super, super vulnerable.
Lola says having a disability ups the stakes for a lot of sex workers.
This is your number one form of income, and this is your number one occupation. And it is that because it is flexible, it suits your needs.
Blunt and Ariel's survey has found that overall, SESTA FOSTA has had a harmful impact on the health of sex workers who are disabled.
Of our online respondents with chronic illness, 26% reported an increase in the exacerbation of their symptoms. So a lot of them have had to return to work that doesn't cater to their disability or it doesn't allow them to take time off.
I ran this argument by Melanie, the advocate who was trafficked as a child, but she wasn't buying it.
Majority, over 98% of individuals who engage in prostitution are vulnerable people already. I think it's highly unfortunate if there's somebody who is disabled, and I do recognize that that puts a strain on their employment opportunities. However, there are so many other ways to work from home that don't involve the constant reusing and repurchasing of your body.
What the argument over SESTA FOSTA gets to is a bigger conflict about prostitution or sex work. Everyone agrees that it can be harmful. The question is, do we try and get rid of it completely? Abolition, supported by laws like SESTA FOSTA, or do we recognize that it will never truly go away and try to make it as safe as possible? Blunt, Ariel, and Lola all told me they're in favor of decriminalization, a movement that's picked up ever more steam thanks in part to SESTA FOSTA, which a coalition of sex worker rights and online free speech advocates are working to challenge in the courts. As for Melanie, she's in favor of a model that maintains penalties for sex buyers and traffickers, but decriminalizes the sex workers themselves. But she says that kind of solution is a long ways away.
I definitely agree that FOSTA SESTA is not the end all be all, and honestly, it was never intended to be, and I think it was a necessary step.
In fact, earlier this year, it gave Melanie the chance to file her own long-awaited lawsuit against Backpage, through which she hopes to get some kind of justice for what she went through.
Once this happens, you can take the person out of prostitution, but you can never take prostitution out of that person. That trauma that comes with it, all of those harms, that's something that me and every other survivor I've ever met will never forget. And we have to live with that every day.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. Coming up, when doctors want their patients to lose weight, they sometimes make matters worse.
I felt insulted, I felt embarrassed, I felt ashamed.
Still to come on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about harm reduction. This idea doesn't only come into play with things like addiction or sex work. Harm reduction is part of larger healthcare too. It's definitely come up with the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, think about it. We wear masks and keep our distance so that we can reduce our risks and still do some of the things we want to do or need to do. But there are broader risk-benefit equations to consider as well. In March, when lockdowns were just beginning, physician David Katz wrote an opinion piece about this in the New York Times.
I asked the question, which is going to hurt more people, infection or the unintended consequences of interdiction for all?
David is the founding director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center in Connecticut. This op-ed got a lot of criticism.
What wound up giving me more notoriety than I ever bargained for was what seemed to me like a common sense assertion. You know, when you're going to cross a busy street, the common knowledge is it's advisable to look both ways first. I looked in one direction and saw, scanning global data, in particular data out of South Korea, which was the first country to do a really good job of doing case ascertainment at scale, I saw that this was not a one-size-fits-all threat.
David argued that some people were far more vulnerable to a bad outcome because of their age or other health conditions. But for many others, cases of COVID-19 were mild and the threat was just not as severe.
Then I looked in the other direction. And as we were starting to contemplate lockdowns and, you know, essentially turning society and industry and the economy off, I started thinking about the social determinants of health. We actually know that the single biggest driver of health outcomes is socioeconomic status, food security, education, the adequacy of shelter. It's not anything about biology. It's, as we often say, it's really more about your zip code than your genetic code. And we know that when you have massive economic upheaval, it falls hardest on the people who can least bear it. So I was really concerned that a lot of people were going to be badly hurt.
And David is still worried about that fallout. People losing their jobs, their livelihoods, kids not being in school. All of this has serious future health consequences. He supports a cautious middle path. Not lockdowns for all, but also not just going back to normal and throwing caution to the wind. He says we need to have a stratified risk approach. As we look around the country, the reopening phase has been difficult in a lot of places. The numbers are going back up. In some places, they are worse than ever. So is it too late to turn this ship around? What can we do right now?
The right remedy, and it is in some sense too late now, because once you have the virus circulating widely and once it circulated in a way where there wasn't really careful protection of the most vulnerable population, so older people, people with chronic illness, you can close the barn doors now, but the horses are all out. We keep missing the opportunity. The right way to have done this, and I do harbor hope that, you know, we can still get it right somewhere, you know, it is to acknowledge that young, healthy people, so, you know, certainly people under 30, but, you know, we can go up to 50, say people who are generally healthy under 50, the risk of a bad outcome from COVID is lower than the risks they encounter in their daily routine. So, for example, if we think about kids going back to school and college students going back to universities, assuming their health is fairly ordinary, the risk of a bad outcome from COVID is less than the risk of a bad outcome from riding the school bus. You know, so at some point we need a reality check and we need to say, you know, the healthy young people can be back out in the world.
David says this would take lots of testing and safety precautions, but ultimately every decision will be a risk-benefit analysis. He also says it's good for us to really think about our own personal risks. Age, how often we're exposed to others, and our general health.
Looking at the distribution of chronic disease risk factors and chronic diseases that we now know markedly elevate the risk of a bad COVID outcome. And that list is not limited to, but includes obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, coronary disease. And looking at the most current data, we find that 60% of Americans have one or more of these major risk factors for a bad COVID outcome, and 40% of Americans have two or more. Now, that's bad news. It's part of the reason why this pandemic is going to be worse in this country than it needed to be. But it's also an opportunity because these risk factors are modifiable with lifestyle as medicine, and they're modifiable in the short term. If you improve your diet, your activity pattern, you can change your immune response. And so I don't think there's ever been a better time for a Let's All Get Healthy Together campaign, making information and programs for healthy eating available to everybody. I would love to see mobile vans that are offering testing for COVID and handing out fresh fruits and vegetables into the bargain. I mean, you know, just clever, fun, engaging things to say our chronic health relates to this acute threat. We ought to be addressing both.
David Katz is the founding director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center in Connecticut. Weight and weight management is really important to our overall health. That's why often you have to step on the scale first thing when you arrive at the doctor's office, or why physicians ask their patients to lose weight. But how this issue is discussed is really important. When it's done with a wagging finger and a dose of shaming, it can cause more harm than good, says Mary Hawk. She is a public health researcher at the University of Pittsburgh.
Your role is not to stop people from harmful health behaviors, which is very paternalistic, but rather to offer them a menu of options and support them in making their best possible choices.
Reporter Alan Yu explores how a harm reduction approach could change the way we talk about weight.
When Philadelphia writer and community organizer Lene Voss was around 12, she went for her annual physical with her mother and sisters. The doctor measured her height and weight and asked her what she liked to eat. She told him she liked sandwiches, and she still remembers what the doctor said.
The doctor turns to my mom in front of both my sisters also. He asked, "So you just let her sit around and eat sandwiches all day and night?" I felt insulted. I felt embarrassed. I felt ashamed. I will never forget that. It made me apprehensive about going to doctors. It made me scared of being weighed. It made me not want to participate in any physical activity.
Nurses, doctors, and other people have commented on her weight for most of her life. Lene describes herself as short, round, and brown. In 2018, she had a serious medical issue, tied directly to how doctors thought about her weight. Early that year, she had a surgery to remove fibroids, non-cancerous tissue growing in her uterus. A few weeks later, she was in a lot of pain.
It felt like what I would imagine searing hot metal just being in my lower abdomen, kind of in perpetuity.
She had trouble eating and sleeping. She was not menstruating. She went to a different doctor, wondering if there was more of that tissue that still needed to come out. But this doctor said no to another surgery because, she said, Lene had too much belly fat.
And I said, this little bit of belly fat is not a reason not to help me. You're telling me you're not helping me because I'm fat.
Lene went to yet another doctor. This one said yes to the surgery.
She saved my life.
Lene's fallopian tubes, which connect her uterus and her ovaries, had swollen from backed up menstrual blood. The swollen tubes were pushing against, possibly damaging nearby organs. She has recovered now. She had her last surgery a year ago. But the way that healthcare providers talked to Lene about her weight over the years has had a big impact.
At one point, it made me not want to go to a doctor ever for anything unless I was really, really sick. And that's not healthy. I am about to turn 40, and that's not how I want to live my life, because I know that preventive care is important. But when you have providers who are so cruel, you have to put on emotional armor just to get help with a sinus infection. Or, you know, or if you're having gut health issues, you know how many times I've been told, well, if you stop eating fried foods, your stomach won't hurt. And I'm not a fried food kind of girl. And even if I were, that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that, like, I need help.
The stigma against people who are overweight leads to them getting less medical care. According to Hannah Blank, a historian and bioethicist at Denison University in Ohio, she studies obesity stigma in healthcare. She says one way this happens is when a doctor prioritizes getting a patient to lose weight above everything else.
Lose weight and it will get better. This is your therapy. Or they put weight loss as a precondition for therapy. In other words, we can't treat you or we can't deal with this issue until you have lost weight.
Part of the problem is the way we define or measure obesity. What is a, quote, healthy weight does not fit neatly into brackets that apply to everyone. Sabrina Strings is a sociologist at the University of California, Irvine. She wanted to study the history of how scientists figured out that high body mass index, BMI, meant bad health outcomes. She says that BMI does not have a direct link to someone's actual health.
The science supporting any connection between obesity, as it is currently defined, and health outcomes is incredibly flimsy. Almost all of this research is correlational research. It's not causal research. And in reality, a lot of the disdain for fat people, even that which exists or has existed historically in the medical establishment, was rooted in race science, dating back into the 18th century.
She traces views of obesity back to French philosophers of that time period, who argued that Africans were prone to overindulging in pleasures and needed to have their appetites for food and sex kept in check. This, and skin color, was part of how colonizers defined Africans as inferior. Some Christian faith groups associated weight with overindulgence in food and drink, and a lack of control. White Americans started to accept these cultural ideas about weight as science. In the early 20th century, insurance companies looked at their data of middle-class white men and figured out that people who weighed less cost them less to insure. Thus, the idea that everyone should fit inside certain weight brackets stuck. Some doctors are working hard to undo those misconceptions.
Unfortunately, most doctors don't know how to treat obesity.
Fatima Stanford is a physician who specializes in obesity at Massachusetts General Hospital.
If you go to your doctor seeking treatment and you're just told to eat less and exercise more, but you've been doing that for the last 30 years, you feel a bit frustrated.
She talks to doctors more than 100 times a year to help them treat patients with dignity and offer personalized approaches to talking about obesity rather than a boilerplate, just lose X number of pounds. And she says the words that a doctor uses matters, like saying a patient who has obesity and not saying an obese patient. This fits in well with the harm reduction model. For example, the harm reduction model would tell a doctor not to shame a patient about weight or impose their personal beliefs. Doctors should understand what kind of food does a patient have access to? What role does food play in their life? What kind of health goal does the patient have? Work with them to achieve those goals.
What I've learned in my many years of practice now, which are over 13 years of practice, is that every single patient really wants to receive things in a way that fits them. And so you have to listen to the cues that the patient is giving you about what things matter to them and use those things that matter to them to help capture how important addressing an issue like obesity might be.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.